Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. On a sunny May morning back in 2013, Jay O'Hara and Ken Ward used a 32-foot lobster boat, plus a 200-pound anchor, to prevent a barge from delivering 40,000 tons of coal to New England's largest fossil fuel-burning power plant, the Brayton Point Power Station in Somerset, Massachusetts. The two were subsequently arraigned on four criminal charges, including conspiracy and negligent operation of a motor vehicle, and they were due to go to trial last Monday. They weren't planning to dispute the facts. Instead, they planned to argue that the government's failure to address climate change justified their actions. It's known as a necessity defense, and it would have been the first time a climate-related necessity defense had gone to trial. But Bristol County District Attorney Sam Sutter didn't think Ward and O'Hara would be able to meet the legal standard for a necessity defense. Still, he sympathized with their argument, so he took matters into his own hands. The morning the trial was due to get underway, he announced that he was dismissing the conspiracy charge, downgrading the remaining three charges to civil infractions. He then left the courthouse waving a copy of an article by Bill McKibben, the environmental author and founder of 350.org. And on the courthouse steps, he declared climate change, quote, one of the greatest crises our planet has ever faced. And he said this of his decision.
The political leadership on this issue has been gravely lacking. I am heartened that we were able to forge an agreement that both parties were pleased with and that appeared to satisfy the police and those here in sympathy with the individuals who were charged. I am also extremely pleased that we were able to reach an agreement that symbolizes our commitment at the Bristol County District Attorney's Office to take a leadership role on this issue.
Amen.
I spoke with the defendants, Ken Ward and Jay O'Hara, the day after the trial was called off. I asked them whether congratulations were in order.
Maybe it's not congratulations, but at least attaboy. You know, it's kind of a strange, unexpected position to be in where the person who is prosecuting you all of a sudden is standing out in front of the courthouse saying essentially we need to do direct action and civil disobedience because the climate issue is not at the forefront of our political discussion.
Are you at all disappointed that the trial didn't go forward? I mean, this was slated to be a bit of a show trial with some very high profile people testifying on your behalf.
Well, I think so on one level, but this is really kind of an extraordinary event to have the DA Sutter take the stance that he did. And so it's really hard to compare the two. It's sort of an apples and oranges thing. I think that probably the thing that we would say we're disappointed is that the plant is still burning coal. But as a matter of politics, this is really an important step to have a prosecutor say this is civil disobedience, needs to be treated as civil disobedience, and is appropriate civil disobedience.
Brayton Point Power Station is slated to close in 2017. They announced earlier this year that they are planning to close that power plant. I take it that's not soon enough for you.
No. I mean, we need to take the obvious steps. And the very first of those steps, the one that Dr. James Hansen lays out, and he's the person we think you should turn to when you're looking for, well, what should we be doing here? Very first step is to stop burning coal. And that's what we need to do.
Dr. Hansen has laid out essentially that globally we need to stop burning coal by 2030 entirely. And if we have any hope and expectation of being able to accomplish that, states like Massachusetts and countries like the United States have to stand up and take moral leadership and start doing this now. Because if we, you know, go along essentially with the Obama administration's regulations, we're going to be nowhere by 2030.
How did you two meet and decide to take this action to drive a lobster boat into the path of a coal barge headed for Brayton Point Power Station?
We thought about it independently. We knew each other. We had done met each other in rallies and a sleep out on the Boston Commons over climate a few years before this action. I had thought that, well, it's really time to do this kind of thing for several different reasons, and Brayton Point was the obvious place to focus because it's such a giant, visible plant, largest coal emitter in New England. And I wanted to find somebody else to do it. And I spent, I don't know, a couple months talking to people, and as I ran across them in normal life and in activist circles. And then I went down to the Boston City Plaza, where a number of people were doing were sleeping out to call on the Senate candidates, U.S. Senate candidates, to address climate. It was the night that Hurricane Sandy is actually starting to come into Boston, so it was a pretty dramatic night with rains and wind slashing in. I went down about 3 o'clock because I thought they were kind of be wet and cold, and I brought some hot cider. And Jay was there. I didn't expect him to be there. And I said, hey, I got this idea of something we might be done at Brayton Point with a boat. And he said, great, let's do it.
Ken doesn't seem to mention this very often, but Ken has been a leading environmentalist and head of several organizations, including a deputy director at Greenpeace USA for a time, and he spent a lot of time thinking about what the environmental movement strategy needs to be on something as large as climate, and that the typical way of doing things just has not worked. I come from a little bit of a different background, which is a religious background. I'm a committed life Quaker, and for me that means trying to live with integrity every part of my life with the truth as I understand it, and certainly truth as revealed through the scientific method as a valuable way to understand truth. And given the truth that we understand, how am I supposed to live my life out? And I've been thinking for some time about that it's time to step up our game and put our lives where our mouths are. And I grew up on Cape Cod. Fall River is the closest plant. Brayton Point is the closest coal plant to me. A lot of the emissions drift downwind to where we are. And when Ken came to Government Center that night on the eve of Hurricane Sandy and brought us some hot cider, it was just a real opening. It was really clear that this was the work that was mine to do and that we were there to do it together.
Can you describe exactly what you did on that morning of May 15th?
Yeah, we awoke really early in Newport, Rhode Island, and after a brief short prayer meeting with our friend Marla on the docks in Newport, we got underway under a cloudless sky on a windless day and motored north through Narragansett Bay. Being able to see online, actually track this shipment of coal on the Energy Enterprise that was coming up from the docks in Norfolk, Virginia. Knowing that it was going to arrive later that day, we anchored our boat in the ship channel in front of this giant pier and this giant power plant and this giant pile of coal in Somerset, dropped anchor and awaited for the ship to arrive and also evidently for the authorities to come too. And there was the Coast Guard who responded first and was there with us and boarded our boat and was on our boat for about 7 hours while they figured out how to deal with us.
Part of figuring out how to deal with it was the fact that you hadn't just dropped any anchor. You had dropped a 200-pound anchor. That doesn't come back up easily.
That's true. We did drop a very large anchor, which was essentially chained to the keel of the boat. So we were trying to make ourselves immovable. And we had positioned the boat in such a way that the coal ship actually docked somewhat safely and there was not a hazard to navigation, but was able to dock safely, just not in a way that they could unload their coal. And there we kind of had the bow of our boats pointed at each other for 5 or 6 hours.
You were in a 32-foot lobster boat, and these coal barges are enormous, 40,000 tons of coal. Did you ever fear for your life?
Well, I will say there was a moment when I was watching this giant self-unloading tanker come towards us and not appear to be slowing down when we thought, well, it would be pretty easy to swamp us here. But it was pretty clear that that's not. I mean, the tanker was being brought in under the control of three tugs and the Coast Guard was there and it was all quite safe and choreographed. It's just, it's a big ship when you're looking up at it. So there was a moment or two.
I'd say the most dramatic part of it was even before the ship arrived. Ken and I were sitting on the transom of the lobster boat, kind of in plain view to assure everyone that we were not a threatening presence, that we were doing a peaceful protest. And over our shoulders, we heard the unmistakable bolt action of a rifle being cocked by the Somerset police, and that was certainly sends a chill up your spine. We were being very cooperative. We had called them to inform them what we were up to, and had been very clear that we weren't a threatening presence to anybody. But that certainly was a hair-raising moment.
Let me ask you about the lobster boat. Was there a symbolism in the choice of that particular type of vessel as opposed to, say, a sailboat?
Well, I'd say they just ended up that we ended up with having a lobster boat. Found this great lobster boat. It looked beautiful. Ken and I both love old wooden boats. So that it was a natural choice. I think the biggest symbolic part of the whole thing was we named the boat the Henry David T after Henry David Thoreau, who spent a lot of time thinking and writing about how, given what we know, how are we supposed to act when there are big changes that need to be made?
I guess for me, seeing the lobster boat in part evoked just how profound some of the shifts going on in New England's waters are as a result of climate change. It seemed to have an added layer of connectedness to the New England situation in particular.
Yeah, we didn't plan this, but man, it was good. I mean, you know, the pictures, the scale, that kind of evocation of a New England that we've lost or losing. The only thing I contributed consciously to this symbolism was to make sure we had an American flag on board. I feel like there's been something of a slippage of it's all of our flags, and we felt we were doing a basic protest in the classic American tradition from the Tea Party on. And we ought to say that, which was easiest to do by flying a flag.
Ken, as Jay alluded to earlier, you have been involved in the environmental movement much of your career. You were deputy director of Greenpeace for a time, and this action has been compared to some of the early Greenpeace actions. What, in your mind, was so different about what you two did blockading this coal shipment as opposed to other climate protests that we've seen in recent years?
Well, I was definitely inspired by the Greenpeace traditions of direct action. What's different about this is that, first of all, it was a direct action, not just a symbolic protest. Direct action means trying to put yourself, your body, at the point of the insult or the injury and prevent it. So we were literally placing ourselves between the coal tanker and the pier. And it's different than from just a symbolic protest that's at a government site or even just holding a placard somewhere. I should say that we had support and assistance from Greenpeace US in the planning of this, which was a great help to us. We didn't have a lot of support. In fact, we had a lot of criticism from within the environmental community when we proposed to do this.
So what was that criticism?
Well, there were a number of organizations that thought that this would complicate rather than expand climate efforts in general, and specifically the efforts to shut down Brayton Point.
And do you feel that's a symptom of the environmental movement becoming too timid?
I think part of the problem that we face is that the environmental movement isn't treating climate appropriately and is way too bound up in the business of politics as usual. And in fact, one of the most interesting things about what happened is we have a Bristol County district attorney who is like a lot of us and a lot of our institutions and all of our environmental groups is faced with the problem of how do you integrate a problem that's bigger than normal life and normal day-to-day politics and work? How do you balance those two? Well, he found some way to do that.
You have a 13-year-old son. I'm curious what his response to this whole, the action and the charges, the trial, the prospect of jail time. What has his response to this been?
He's 14 now. I've talked to him twice since coming back out here. The first thing he said was, geez, really don't want you to go to jail. And I said, oh, thanks for your concern. And he said, well, yeah, I'm concerned about you, but I don't want my friends to know that my dad's in jail. I was like, oh, well, that's okay. But I talked to him this morning, and he said, hey, I hear you're famous. he read the New York Times, so I think to see your dad quoted in the New York Times, he was kind of proud of that.
Does he share your concern about climate change and the future into which he's growing up?
Well, my experience of not so much talking to Eli is listening to Eli and his friends talk. I mean, I think we've got a generation that's got an underlying sense of things being terribly wrong. They don't really necessarily know. I mean, they can talk about climate. They know what the information is. But it's more of a sense, and it's very sad, I think, to listen to this sense that something's going amiss, you know, before they're even grown up. And I think it's very painful, and it's certainly one of the things that, I mean, I do this for a lot of reasons, but I very much do it, and at any point where I'm faced with something difficult or scary, it's pretty easy for me to go, well, I want to make sure that for my boy that I have tried everything I can think of. I don't want to have come up with something, well, here's something we could have done, and I don't do it.
In my generation, I'm 32, and so I guess I'm at the older end of the millennials. Almost all of my peers have that same underlying sense of something is desperately wrong, but we're all struggling to find what our point of agency in this is. What is where is it that our daily lives can meet the enormity of this crisis? And it's a crisis not just of the physical nature of the planet, but of the fact that our political and economic systems aren't equipped to deal with the problem of this magnitude. Well, if that's the case, how am I supposed to live my life? And we don't have easy answers yet. And part of the problem, I think, is that we don't yet have a set of leadership in the environmental movement or in the political sphere that shows with their lives committed on the line what that life should be and look like.
Jay, when you and I met a few years ago, you were bicycling everywhere. What does your daily life look like at this point?
In general, my daily life is, and this is a long-standing Quaker tradition, a long-standing tradition in a lot of faith traditions, that in order to focus on what is most important, we need to clear away the clutter and free our lives to follow where we are led. And so for me, I work part-time as a sailmaker, a job which is pleasurable and enjoyable, working with my hands on a day-to-day basis, but have simplified my life to the point where I only need to do that part-time so that the rest of my life is free to pursue the really important work that we're free to pursue. I'm not yet ready to crucify myself on the hypocrisy of whether or not I occasionally ride in cars or drive cars. I don't own one at this point. I tend to take the bus or ride a bike or sail where I'm going. I live on a sailboat in the summer. And my partner and I, Meg, sailed to the trial. But for me, the spiritual discipline comes back to kind of one of my guiding principles. It comes from a poem by Mary Oliver called Wild Geese, in which she says, you do not have to be good. You do not have to crawl on your knees through the desert for 100 miles repenting. You simply have to love what the soft animal of your body loves. And for me, that kind of giving over, that confessional nature of a life trying to align with what we know deeply in our hearts to be true regardless is at the center. And I can't allow myself to get hung up necessarily on the day-to-day. I have to keep my focus, as the civil rights movement said, keep my eye on the prize.
Jay O'Hara, Ken Ward, attaboy, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Heather.
District Attorney Sutter has been careful to say that any precedent set by Ward and O'Hara's case would be limited to extremely similar situations within Bristol County. Of course, the two contend that clears the way for others to disrupt operations at Brayton Point Power Station, precisely as they did. The two say they're planning to start a climate disobedience center to help others navigate the complexities of planning just such acts of protest. And that's our show for today. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw through the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.